I think we're just going to go ahead and kick it off, and hopefully some more people trickle in. But my name is Lucia Prieslak, and I am the director of the Uproot Project. And I'm just going to go ahead and introduce my panelists. We have Adam Ashton from the Rocky Mountain Institute. We have Heather Kostick from the Department of Earth and Environmental Science at UPenn. And we have Sophia Prado-Huggins from the Uproot Project. And we're just going to make this more of an intimate conversation than a panel, but I'm just going to kind of kick it off with a question to you all. I was wondering if you can just talk about what your experience is professionally using social media, and how do you feel social media is most important to be used professionally by journalists or in your respective organizations?
Well, I'll kick it off. Here, I'll put this a little closer. So I work for a center at Penn, the Penn Center for Science, Sustainability, and the Media. You might have seen our table in the exhibitors hall because Philadelphia and UPenn are the hosts for the conference next year. And our center is all about climate change communication. So for us, what it means is communicating the work we're doing as a center. But as individuals, our individual research and views may not necessarily be the same type of social media use as we would use for our center. So our center is more about, like, the social media aspect is education, saying what we're doing. Maybe our director, Dr. Michael Mann, received an award or published a paper, or maybe our center is publishing papers. So we use social media more as an educational format. But on a personal side of things, as individual researchers and scientists, we're using it primarily, I think, to engage with people and for science communication. So for us, it's kind of twofold. We have the center that we, you know, has its own interests, and we kind of treat that as a nonpartisan, apolitical center. But as individuals, as scientists, I think, you know, we're expressing our own personal views on our individual social media accounts, which are not necessarily associated with the center. And I think, so for us, there's that duality.
I can go next. So I run the social media for the Uproot Project, and the goals of our social media are probably a little bit different than they are for individual journalists. The Uproot Project, for those of you who don't know, is a network for and by environmental journalists of color, and our social media, our main goals are to amplify the voices of these environmental journalists and our Uproot members, and also to foster a sense of community. So we get to be a little bit more playful, I think, than perhaps some of the other institutes and organizations here.
Yep, thanks. Hey, everyone. First of all, thank you for coming. Also, happy Earth Day, I think, if I can be the first to say that. Just as a micro summary of RMI, Rocky Mountain Institute, we were founded 41 years ago today on Earth Day, which I'm happy to say. And thank you. Thank you. And it's interesting because back then in 1982, doing math before coffee, we were a little group, very focused on some wonky issues around buildings. Climate wasn't certainly on the wider debate. And we were six people. Today, RMI is 650 people, and we're operating in 61 countries, and we're looking across, you know, global sectors of thing, you know, massive wedges of the whole emissions pie, like electricity, buildings, transportation, and industry. And so I joined this huge party about a year ago, having been a climate journalist and energy journalist at some business magazines for a while. Very interested increasingly, I think, as a lot of journalists in the space struggle with the question of how do I've written about this a lot. I feel like I'm advancing the agenda that way, but wanting to get a little closer to a little bit of the application. So come to the conversation today, I think, with one eye, a little bit dormant, though, having been a journalist trying to build my own reputation, visibility, brand on Twitter and the like. And now inside the beehive of RMI, where we're running, we have trouble keeping track. We think we have 67 different social accounts right now across 12 programs. That doesn't include the individuals. And a little bit like the University of Pennsylvania or other big organizations, What's different from 1982, when Amory Lovins, our founder, wrote a paper, the way that would get to the world, of course, was, you know, you'd send out literally a press release, a physical press release. They'd call people. You'd get, you know, the news would move slowly through a very small number of channels. Today, we're pushing the work we do out, which is we publish probably 30 to 50 pieces of content and 100 reports a year. It's a lot of stuff across not just those channels, but every other way we can, individuals, events, et cetera. And we're trying really earnestly to find new audiences, right? We're good at talking to other wonky kind of brain trusts of policy people, but we have a great problem right now, which is that the climate discussion has moved from kind of academic argument, discussion, planning, theory, analysis, next into policy. And we were surprised in a great way when the IRA passed this year, and suddenly there's a big, big push to deploy money into communities, many of which don't have much climate expertise. There's urban planners and county commissioners looking to figure out, what should I do with my heat pump policy? What is that heat pump? So finding those communities for us has gotten actually to be more and more important. We know we can talk to the experts, but as the mandate of the climate sort of agenda gets bigger, the urgency grows, and the interested number of interested people, both at the kind of technical level, but also this groundswell, the fact that SEJ is bigger here than it's been in history, I think speaks to the fact that students, journalists, young professionals are all looking to the space. So we're trying to pull RMI kind of out of an ivory tower sort of, you know, expert-to-expert voice into a wider one. And so part of my recent history, for example, in the last 3-4 days was talking to one of our senior people about whether or not we should be on Twitter anymore. Is Twitter a toxic platform? Is it too risky for us? If we're not there, where should we be? I'm ready. One of the things we're looking at more and more closely, and I'm interested to hear about from you guys, is the shift from of journalists as Twitter gets a little more toxic to places like LinkedIn. But we're talking about TikTok too. It's this incredibly like vibrant community of climate people, of from youth organizers in other countries to oil workers in Oklahoma. They're making videos about, you know, what they do and how they do it. And can we, like a kind of business suited stodgy organization, be there? Is it a place where we look for people? Can we start conversations there? Those are all kind of questions we're reckoning with. Yeah.
I want to add to that. Can everyone hear me? Yeah. Okay. I'm used to lecturing, so this is not difficult for me. Yeah.
Since it's being recorded.
Oh, is it being recorded? Okay, sure.
All sessions are being recorded.
So. Yeah. So to your point, Adam, about thinking about things like TikTok and Twitter, unfortunately our AV is not up at the moment, but my boss and director of our center, Michael Mann, is a really good example of engaging on Twitter right now, and he and quite a few other scientists over the last few days have been talking about the changes that have been happening on Twitter, where random celebrities and well-known people are having blue ticks added where they didn't have it before, or they're getting it removed in Michael Mann's case. And, you know, even though this is all happening and it's the landscape of Twitter has changed, to put it lightly, there are still a fraction of people that are saying, like, this isn't normal. We're still going to be putting out this information. So while I agree that Twitter is definitely changing and edging on toxic, if it's not already, there's still people out there trying to combat that and share information. And I still think that in some ways it's salvageable, but there's also TikTok, the other side of it. I did a piece for our center called TikTok for Climate Change. You can find it on our website. And I talked to a couple of content creators on TikTok who are climate activists. And it's a really interesting way for people to engage with climate change, to be educated, to kind of get involved in climate activism where they might not have otherwise. And since our center is so interested in how climate change is communicated, we kind of say we study the science of climate change communication. That means looking at places like TikTok. One of the content creators that I interviewed, they are known for their catchphrase, which is bully the rich. So this person bullies oil companies, and yeah, it's they do really incredible work.
But the side of that is they have, because of the way that the algorithm on TikTok works, they have cultivated this community of people. And they're not the only ones. There's other climate activists. I see journalists, TikTok content creators that are kind of turned journalists, or just educators that are TikTok content creators. And they're able to cultivate this community of people who care about these issues. And the fun anecdote that I like to share, and my panelists wanted to make sure I shared it today, was this TikTok creator, I believe it's show_me_your_mask, they ended up on a side of TikTok after bullying the rich and talking about oil executives and how bad the conditions were for oil rig workers. They ended up on a side of TikTok with the oil rig workers because of all the negative feedback they were getting from these workers being like, you know, like, this is my livelihood, ba-ba-da-ba-da. And they very much did get vitriol, but they used that opportunity to engage with those people and said, like, okay, I hear you. Tell me about your work. And then ended up, like, I'd say they said, like, about 50% of the people they talked to that were oil rig workers ended up kind of being like, yeah, well, these conditions are really hard. We very much feel trapped by the oil companies because they only pay us a certain amount. We're contracted a certain way. It's kind of like if you think about the old mining towns where miners would kind of get stuck working for the mining company generation after generation because of the conditions. Oil rig workers seem to be experiencing a similar thing. And this TikTok creator was like, okay, well, let's share resources like workforce development, renewable energy workforce resources, and things of that nature. So ended up kind of taking that toxic thing that I think is very pervasive on Twitter, where you're seeing a lot more professional trolls and bots that are intentionally spreading misinformation and disinformation. Not that it doesn't happen on other social media platforms, including TikTok. But this creator was able to take that experience and turn it into, I don't want to say into their favor, but into the favor of better information and go from there. So I think that...
There's a key fob attached to it right now if you drag those on or open those up.
So I think that's kind of where I'm going to end that. Sophia, if you want to jump in.
I feel like we're all kind of talking about the way that social media feels like it's in a moment of transition, which is funny because social media is always constantly changing, and it has been since before the internet. But with the way that Twitter is evolving so quickly day to day and people trying to find different platforms to replicate that experience, new platforms like TikTok, that I think that, like, as a person who works in social media, I'm finding it's an exciting time for experimentation, for developing this sense of community. But I also sense that, like, it is what people want out of social media is in a moment of transition, and it even on spaces like Twitter and spaces like LinkedIn. I think that that platforms like TikTok, like Instagram, are going to affect how social media is being used across these other platforms.
Yeah, I totally agree. And since I have the screen grabs up, I want to show you some examples of how Michael Mann uses Twitter, even in this environment where they're dealing with so much issues change over when Elon decides to, you know, change the status of the company. I'll skip over it. I have a couple of other graphics, but I'll skip to the tweets.
That's working.
So I just grabbed a couple of relatively recent tweets from Michael Mann, who is very good about engaging with people on Twitter. I did not bring up some of the spicier tweets. You can go to his Twitter account and see for yourself. But I did want to share examples of, as journalists, like, if you're thinking about how am I supposed to be engaging with people, because I think you should be if you're telling stories and sharing information, I think these are a really good example of, like, no, the information you're seeing isn't real. Here's the real information. And then this is from a thread where Michael's talking about the Six Americas, which is a survey that comes out periodically from Yale Climate Communication and GMU, basically talking about that, like, the majority of Americans are either alarmed or concerned. The majority of Americans are in this group. But the Twitter bots, the professional trolls, they don't want you to know that. They are hoping that the doomism and misinformation and disinformation is getting to you. So this is just a couple of examples I wanted to share of his tweets. I think I have one more. And he also retweets other academics, communicators, journalists who are sharing this information. So I just wanted to share a couple. And the Six Americas thing that I referred to, just so you can see, there's, nope, that's not, sorry, I'm not used to this format. This is one of the, just an example of a graphic from that to show you that the majority of Americans are alarmed and concerned. There's, and it has, this alarmed bubble has doubled twice since 2012, so it's gone from like 12 to 26%. So people are becoming more alarmed as time goes on, and the majority of Americans at this point are alarmed and concerned. So people do believe that climate change is an issue, and the bots and the professional trolls want you to believe otherwise.
Can I, just as a quick exercise, raise your hand if you are on Twitter now, actively using it. Like most everyone, okay. Raise your, or keep your hand up. Are you decreasing your use or finding it less reliable or suspicious in any way? Yeah? Okay, interesting. So almost all of you, yeah. That's interesting. Maybe just to build on what you were saying, we see it obviously as a really important portal. You know, as I mentioned, I was both a journalist and now I'm on the kind of the expert side. We want the journalists to be able to find us there, but are seeing data from a marketing and audience analytics group showing that a lot of journalists are moving to Twitter. I'm sorry, to LinkedIn. I mentioned that earlier, rather, which is, I think, surprising to some people. I know internally when I said that we should be putting more content there and promoting more and more visible. If you haven't engaged with it in the way, as you might Twitter, an information source, a live dynamic of conversation, you think of it as a place where you look for a job. But Microsoft's done a really remarkable job at growing it, and it's gained something. It's now in the top three. It's over a billion users globally. And for us at RMI, we're seeing it as the main conduit increasingly for journalists with inbound questions. When we put content onto it, the algorithm there is so good at slicing away the layer of kind of noise. You saw me pointing at the Twitter that's no longer there anymore, mm-hmm. but that it's the algorithm and the kind of community environment is much safer, basically. It's more audited, vetted, proven, known identities, those sorts of virtues, which not long ago were kind of boring and made it not a place you wanted to hang out very much. It's not an entertaining place, but when you look at across like Hootsuite studies of how audiences go to different platforms, Twitter and LinkedIn has just emerged, is on par with Twitter as a place for news, and especially for technical news. So a lot of academics and, you know, policymakers will go there. And so we're increasingly using it to kind of put content kind of available organically. And I talked with another editor last night at a dinner, from DeSmog, who was saying that they're using LinkedIn, paid LinkedIn to target audiences. So if they write something about, say, Chevron, I'm making this as hypothetical, they'll target former employees of Chevron about the work, and they'll use that also as a research tool. On LinkedIn, you can find former employees of Chevron with 5 years ago or more, and if you want to discover, for example, you know, dissent or people who have knowledge of a company's operations but aren't there any longer and get background, it becomes a really useful, hyper-accurate tool, which the other player we haven't mentioned too much here, Facebook, which has gone through, you know, not quite the decline in reputation, but certainly is full of misinformation and reputational issues and similarly. But it used to have similar targeting capabilities, I know, for a lot of journalists who would use it, and you could go and dive in pretty deeply. But LinkedIn is kind of the gravity for us, and I'm hearing anecdotally from some journalists it's becoming another tool, if not their main tool, more and more. So we're beginning to invest more, you know, just make sure our content is there. Sometimes first, because our site is not big. You know, if we get 6,000, 10,000 hits on a piece, we're excited. But you can see something travel on LinkedIn across the entire electric regulatory utilities community in like a day, and that's 30,000 people who are super expert in a space, and they're all really there in a kind of common mission. They want to see the content. They want to engage in it. It's a much more supportive environment and a better community in that way for technical audiences. Not for every audience, certainly, but for some of the expert ones.
Yeah, we are not using LinkedIn as much, but I think that is probably because there's a very different mission for our social media than it sounds like yours is. Ours is definitely more about community engagement. And from what I know of LinkedIn, and it doesn't sound like maybe that's perhaps its strong suit. Mm-hmm. So we're still using Twitter. We have seen a lot of people migrating away from Twitter usage because of the increased toxicity. But instead of moving towards a platform like LinkedIn, we're putting more of our energy into Instagram and our emerging TikTok presence, which is, it's definitely a shift, but it's an exciting and fun one. But it comes with other challenges, I think, that are interesting in the sense that you have to like feed the algorithms for these respective platforms in a very different way than you would on Twitter. And we talked, like, full transparency, we had an amazing conversation between the three of us last week, I think. And so we were going to be, like, bringing stuff in from that conversation, I think. And we talked a lot about community building and how that can help in this age of misinformation and disinformation to create this, you know, you put effort and intentionality into building your community in these spaces like Twitter, but TikTok and Instagram specifically, and that builds your ethos, right? You're going to be intentionally creating your audience by feeding the algorithm what it wants. And then after you've built that relationship and you have that like personal credibility with your audience, you sort of can be a little bit more, not combative, but maybe assertive about things in exactly the way that the Bully the Rich content creator on TikTok does. And that actually works super well for Uproot because at least for me, that community is basically the guiding principle behind anything that I post for the Uproot project.
And I want to add, since you're talking about community building right now, that part of this, some of the authors of the Six Americas, the graphics that I showed a little while ago, they're really big on consensus messaging, and that is to say that, like, basically, the trolls, the bots, anyone who's actively engaged in a disinformation or misinformation campaign knows that consensus messaging is powerful. And that's to say consensus messaging is basically like, for example, over 90% of scientists agree that climate change exists and is a problem. That has real meat behind it that these bots and misinformation people don't want you to know about. So having a community and creating a community that you can share information with and that trusts you in some way, I think speaks to being able to have that consensus messaging. So if you're an individual trying to share the pieces you're putting out or you really want to start sharing more information, I think building your community, whether you do that on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, even Facebook, I don't know if people are doing that as much anymore, but using your community to kind of make sure that they're getting the right information, I think, is part of being able to, like, this community clearly wants to engage with you because of the type of work you're doing. So I think having some respect for them, telling them correct information and making sure that, you know, they understand it, I think is key in continuing that community relationship. And I think that's why Show Me Your Mask, the TikTok content creator that I talked about that does Bully the Rich, I think that's why they have such a strong online presence.
And I think that they will, if TikTok goes through whatever banning thing that the government wants to do, I still think they will have a very strong presence on social media because of the community that they created on TikTok has followed them to other platforms. And similar to Adam asking y'all questions, I'm curious, is anybody here using TikTok for anything?
Even entertainment.
Just yeah, I'm just curious. Yeah, okay, you're using, like, personal use? Yeah, okay. I was just curious. I think it is kind of hard to get into that space as a professional, and especially we're a center at a university, so it can be hard to create content, especially when our center is so new. We're only 9 months old, we started in September. So our TikToks are like, okay, we have to see like what trends are happening, and we have an undergraduate that helps with us. And so Sophia's talking about like feeding the algorithm. On TikTok in particular, that is, I think, what can be more difficult. But I think once you do find your niche on TikTok, it can really help you create that community that you might be looking to engage with.
And not to mention that like creating content for Instagram, but especially for TikTok, like short form video is very good, and it takes a lot of time to do well. It is much easier for me to write like 40 tweets than it is to create one TikTok video. However, it's like you have to put your energy into what's going to really suit your purpose the most, and especially in this moment of shift, I think, you know, experimenting with these newer, perhaps more intimidating forms of social media is important. I'm gonna like shift a little bit away from like the technical aspect of creating social media. And like one of the things that we talked a lot about last week is the fact that we're talking from this perspective of running organizational social media accounts, which provides me and then whoever's like in charge of these accounts a level of protection that a lot of journalists, especially Uproot members who are journalists of color, don't have. And so that like if I post something on Twitter about natural gas and it's just like a silly little meme, suddenly all of the natural gas trolls come out of the woodwork. And but they're, you know, to me, they're just boosting the engagement. They're not attacking me personally. They don't know that I'm the person behind the account. So I have this level of like, oh, well, they're just boosting my numbers right now, and I can ignore it. An individual journalist has completely, like, does not have that institutional protection that I do. And so when it comes to how you're going to engage with that misinformation and disinformation, those trolls, that the bad actors online, the choices that an organization makes are different, are like necessarily different from the boundaries and the considerations that an individual has to put in place for themselves. And
yeah, no, I totally agree. I think that especially for journalists or anybody that is a not white cis person, like, they're going to experience more vitriol. It's a fact. And I do want to speak to the fact that I think that if you're able to, as a white person, speak up for these people and engage, I mean, not, you don't want to feed the trolls. I do not encourage feeding the trolls. It's going to be counterproductive. But if you have people who are engaging with you saying, like, they're not being like, you know, a keyboard troll warrior, I'll say, and they're actually like asking questions, but they're a little, you know, they've got a little bit of spice or vinegar to them, I think that you can sometimes engage with that and potentially have productive conversations. I do see it occasionally on Michael Mann's Twitter account. Again, my boss has a great example of a Twitter account of how to kind of deal with that sort of thing. But again, he has the protection of the university, his name, his body of work. And our center also has the protection of the university. We also engage in a different way, but I can understand as an individual, you know, and I think it's cool. It's what Uproot is doing, is trying to create a sense of community. Because if you have that sense of community, then you're not necessarily alone. And I think that's something to keep in mind when you're engaging on these social media platforms, and something that I think Show Me Your Mask deals with in getting onto the wrong side of TikTok, that their community comes out and says, I'll comment on your videos to make sure you're getting engagement so that you don't end up on the wrong side of the algorithm. And then I think the same thing can kind of happen on other social media platforms. Mm-hmm. Maybe not as strongly as TikTok, because it is very, like, algorithm-based. Not that the others aren't, but in a different way. So I think it gets back to building that sense of community and making sure that you're engaging them in a way that allows you to have more support so that you're not alone mm-hmm. when you're doing this sort of thing.
Yeah, we Uproot hosted like a virtual panel about social media. I think it was last year, like end of last year.
Beginning of this year.
Beginning of this year. I can't. Time is a construct. and one of the it was a great discussion. And one of the things that really, really has stuck with me since then is we were talking about journalists dealing with trolls, and one of the other panelists suggested that a great way to be in community with these journalists is if you see someone experiencing harassment online, like, it's great if you can offer support in the comments, but sometimes just DM them, like, reach out to them privately to ask, like, how can I help? What can I do? Let them know that they're not alone. Like, I think about that, like, once a week. I think it's important to think about other ways besides just engaging in the comments that we can use social media as a means of support and community.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I totally agree. And I think Instagram and TikTok in particular lend itself to being more like, you know, DMing somebody to check in on them, basically, and create that sense of community. I hear TikTokers say it all the time. Well, my mutual, I guess that means friends, DM'd me, and I'm still a little unclear.
It means, like, you follow them and they follow you.
Thank you. So they'll say, like, your my mutual buddy. And I were DMing about this particular topic, and, you know, that creates both of those people are then not alone. So I think it speaks to what Sophia is saying. And I'm curious if you guys have any thoughts on from an RMI perspective on that sort of thing.
We are babes in the woods in this, I have to say. And we have just had a go-around with it. One of my colleagues just joined us, Rachel, who has been in the thick of it. We were co-authors of a report on gas stove-related asthma incidents in homes, which is it's a fascinating case study. Very quickly, if you weren't familiar with it, we and others have done that research dating back 30 years. It's very established, non-controversial science. It is tactically and strategically for this team a really great way, almost the idea that if it's hard to get an audience to understand what is natural gas, what role does it play in your life, a stove is an object people relate to, they understand it. So there was a purposeful kind of focus on that as a way to get audiences and consumers to understand it. So republished a meta study of already existing research showing a very high incidence, a 13% correlation between household asthma, gas stove use in unvented kitchens. So it has been published before in various ways with very little pickup, you know, for better or worse. It was, however, coincident in the last year or so with the natural gas troll army, the Trump troll army. There were other trolls that were, like, if you'd spent time looking through I couldn't handle the feed, honestly. It was just too much. But we have a superhero author, Brady Seals, one of the authors of the paper, who's been through that ringer quite a lot. And I'd say it's a good example of the reason that institutionally we have experts who are a little shy of it, because they don't know how to handle it exactly. Mm-hmm. They're very science-minded, very fact-based. They want to just put information out, and it can really spook them, and it really does stifle the debate, and it's unfair. As an organization, I think another thing we can do tactically is to put forward simple, fact-based information around the topic that's really clear and transparent. A lot of what happens in the troll debate, and in a way, one of the I think my catharsis around it was, all in the end, it doesn't matter too much if you engage with the trolls, because their energy is very sort of self-sustaining. It doesn't travel much beyond their bubble. It's not persuading other people. What we found in sort of the meta-analysis of what happened with this is it was extra traffic to the issue. We found all these interesting examples of mom groups, mom newsletters, kind of considering stoves in their kitchens for the first time because it's about their kids' health. And the controversy had spun it up and dusted it into these corners of conversation where they might be in your kind of an, framework of climate opinion neutral in the middle. They're worried about it. They don't know much to do, but suddenly they have a hand, a kind of a handle to get around it. And ultimately, we want them. That's an audience we really want to consider it. So what we did in order to kind of neutralize any further misinformation from the troll army was, you know, to create a simple fact sheet so that when other, when Fox News or other, you know, critics would call us back and we could just point to it, this is on the record, here's the history of it, we're not going to engage in the sort of tit-for-tat debate with you, you can investigate and establish it yourself. It tends to silence them, basically. There's no feed for them anymore, but not entirely, at least, but they can't keep chasing us and kind of, you know... fighting us about the messaging rather than the facts, which is a lot of what this is about, you know.
And I want to add, because your comments reminded me, there was a panel yesterday on reporting like extreme heat and kind of dealing with that. And there was a meteorologist, I'm blanking on her name, but she was talking about how she works for Televisa Univision and mentioned that she surveyed her audience, basically, and was like, do you believe in climate change? Do you want to see climate change as part of like your weather reporting so you can see the connections between the two? And the majority of the respondents were overwhelmingly yes. There was one chemtrail person who, you know, had to say something about chemtrails the whole survey. But overwhelmingly, between like 85 to 90% of her responses she received were in favor of, yes, they believed in climate change because they understood how it impacted their livelihood. A lot of her audience does outside type jobs, whether that's landscaping, farming, et cetera. So these issues impact them directly. And I think it speaks to, like, you're talking about the moms that see the natural gas. People want to hear this information. Mm-hmm. And I think depending on your community and how it's built and how you engage with it, there is a hook there somewhere that's going to engage people. And, like, whether it's natural gas and their children's health or farmers who are seeing their crops not doing what they expect because the weather isn't, or the climate isn't the same the way it used to be. Or the weather's more extreme in one way or the other. So my point to all that was basically like there is something that can get the community engaged and combat the troll stuff. There's always going to be a small percentage of people that don't believe the consensus, the majority. And the trolls want you to think that that percentage is so much larger than it actually is. If you're thinking of the Six Americas surveys and other surveys that have been done, the percentage of people who actually don't believe that there is an issue is much smaller. It's around 6 to 10%. And I heard yesterday in that same panel somebody challenged that 10%, and I would too. It's a very small but very loud and aggressive group of people that we're fighting against. The majority of people want this information. They want to hear about it. They might be on the fence. They might be in that more neutral space, but they want to hear this information. So I think it's just about like building your community, making sure that people are supported, and then getting them the information that they're looking for. And the hook is whatever that your specialty, I guess, happens to be, whether you're doing natural gas stuff, reporting on the weather, disseminating information, bringing journalists together.
I'm just always going to take things to the abstract because that's where I like to play. I think that one of the things that hearing you guys talk is really coming to mind is this idea that we have, that this like broad idea that there's a difference between like the facts and the like unbiased, if that's even a thing that people can be, and then this like community human aspect. We tend to think of those things as like dissociated. There's like the realm of science and then the human, and I think that really what journalists are doing and what science communication is learning to do more and more is to realize that those things can't be dissociated, that that science is made by humans, and that the persuasiveness, like the rhetorical power of like this is just facts, is really strong and not something to be disregarded. But bringing that into a human element is so powerful. We're not trained to do that. You know, we're siloed into humanists and scientists, and the real rhetorical power, and the possibility of social media is to bring those two things together.
Questions?
Yeah,
I want to hear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you
want? Oh, you want to run the mic? Thank you.
Yeah.
I turned it back off because I wasn't sure if it would make bad noises. Did not want that to happen. The power button's a little finicky.
Yeah.
Hello.
Did it run out of button?
Hello.
There you go. Thank you. So, can you say your name?
Yeah, Frank Bunjum, SEJ member. I lead the Covering Climate Collaborative and ran that panel yesterday. So I love that you loved it. Just for the sake of discussion, to push back a little on, it feels more dire. The journalists I work with, quick backstory to the question, journalists I work with struggle with the percent of time, so Michael Mann and Catherine Hayhoe both, the amount of time they're now spending per day blocking, that's not content creating, that's not informing. So the menial task of blocking, I mean, I'd love to see a show of hands of who's been doxxed for their climate reporting as an individual, if anyone. But if that happens to you, it's intimidating, it's silencing. I appreciate the many quotes of the Yale Climate Opinion Survey. The biggest takeaway to me is the gap between what the public says they think scientists think about the cause of climate change versus what scientists... There's still a huge gap between the fact that scientists agree and what the public thinks on that. So I feel like all of the swarming of trolls works. And so I would love to hear you talk a little more practically, less theoretically, about how do individual journalists make that business decision about using or reallocating their time toward troll swatting. Can we afford to ignore the trolls given that it does seem to work?
Do you want to go away?
Yeah.
So I think it depends on the type of vitriol you're getting. I think that we would be remiss to not acknowledge that doxing and releasing of your personal information, even if it's not as extreme as doxing can be, is a risk to individual journalists. And I would say from a practicality standpoint, from our center's perspective, the way that we engage with trolls tends to be we don't. In fact, we will block them, we will ignore them. And it is effective in that, you know, it's getting attention on your issue, but it also, it is a risk. It is a risk to individuals. As a center, again, we have that protection of the university, and if it's not me handling the social media, it's our undergrad social media assistant. She does a lot of our communications stuff for us. And so we have that protection as a center, and as an individual, I think it's a lot harder to make those decisions, and I think that it's a very personal decision. I would be very hesitant to say how much you should or shouldn't engage, because I think it depends on how much, because I think, we'd be remiss to say that it doesn't take a toll on your mental health. I have a dear friend who is a gaming reporter, and they have received death threats and dox threats for supporting female gamers. And I don't know how familiar you were with the issues a few years ago when that happened, but he was one of the people that came out in support of them and received a lot of threats. He's still continuing to do that work. I will not go on to say how severe the threat was or anything of that nature, but he's still doing the work of supporting diversity in gaming despite the fact that he received those threats. And it's a personal decision. I'm sure it comes down to the fact that, you know, he has a family to think about, and how would he want to seem to his children, perhaps, things of that nature. So, again, I think it's a very, I'm making some guesses based on the person that I know. But I think, again, it's a very personal decision how much you choose to engage as a journalist, because there is a real risk to it. And especially if you're a journalist of color, woman, trans, any of those non-white cis categories, you're putting yourself at even greater risk. So I think it depends on how much you can handle, honestly. And Michael Mann and Catherine Cahill, like, they are out there every day, kind of. I am amazed at how much Mike engages on Twitter and how much he, you know, will snap back at maybe not necessarily trolls, but people who are trying to repeat the stuff that trolls are doing. And I can't speak to how much blocking and things of that nature he's doing, but it is a choice he's making every day because he's decided he can handle it. So, again, I would hesitate to make any sweeping statements about what you should or shouldn't do, because I think it is a very personal decision, and it depends on how much protection you have as a journalist, whether you're associated with larger, like major dailies or anything like that.
Yes to everything you just said. It's like a deep, the for individuals, it's something that they have to consider their circumstances and what is going to be right for them, and the people who have more institutional power, organizations also, I think, have an ethical responsibility to do what they can to protect the people who are experiencing harassment. I know at Grist, there, I don't know if it's a policy already or it's in the works, but there's like a support policy for any employee that experiences online harassment, where the company would put actual money behind protecting them, like if they have to move because they were doxxed. Like, that is the kind of thing that, if you have institutional power, that is what we should be doing. I think it's, you know, for those people who choose to engage more with that side of the online space because they feel like they can, that's great. But when you have some sort of power, then I do think you have the responsibility to use that to protect the people who are most vulnerable.
I want to add one more thing to that. So our center, the Penn Center for Science, Sustainability, and the Media, shares its home with Annenberg Public Policy Center, which is the founder and home of factcheck.org. And factcheck.org folks that work for that particular website often can receive threats. Luckily, they have some of the institutional protection of Penn to help them when that happens. So I won't go into further detail about what that protection looks like, but it is there. And I think that it's important to acknowledge that institutions should and can, where they're able to in these particular instances, deal with those sorts of threats. And again, if you don't have that kind of protection from an organization, it's all down to what you're able to individually handle.
And, like, no judgment at all if you decide that, like, that's not safe for you. That's not going to work for you. Like, as an individual, that's absolutely within your right to decide.
Yeah. Please say your name. Hi, Paula Rosa. I'm from Uproot Project. And I'm a freelance journalist. In my experience, it's almost in past newsrooms I've been, it's almost an expectation to deal with online harassment. You know, Sophia, you kind of mentioned how, you know, Grist is implementing. Is there more of a shift for how newsrooms can support journalists that deal with that kind of online vitriol? And what would that look like?
Yeah. Well, so I'm like a newbie into the journalist space, so I don't know if there is more of a shift, but I definitely think that there should be more of a shift. And I think that putting your, like, that newsrooms should put their money where their mouth is. Like, if they need to spend money in order to create safe living conditions for their journalists, I mean, like, that's what they should be doing. This is like completely off the cuff here, so don't hold me to it, but like providing mental health resources, if there's an expectation that your employees are going to be dealing with harassment, then there should be policies in place to help them deal with that, both like practical realities of that and then the mental toll. Otherwise, that's exploitative.
Yeah, I agree with Sophia here. I'm also a newbie to the journalism space. I am a scientist. Like most of my professional experience has been in science, and I've done SciComm over the years. But I'm not a journalist. And what I would say in my limited experience is, I totally agree with Sophia. I very much believe that if you are doing work for an organization, outlet, whatever it is, they should be providing resources to deal with harassment, because there are other examples of scientists I know at Penn that do certain types of work, especially if it involves animal testing. PETA, you know, gets upset about it from time to time and makes threats to these individuals, which ends up ramping up security depending on where they are on campus. So that example I could speak to a little more freely, but again, that's the university using their resources to protect their scientists in the ways that they're able to. Newsrooms should be doing the same thing, especially if they're doing potentially contentious stories or stories that have a lot of vitriol or that can be really high profile and potentially attract that sort of attention. So, and I think that those that rely on freelance journalists should recognize that the freelance journalists, they don't have the same protection. I feel like this, again, off the cuff, and I don't want to be held to this, but again, I think whether you're a freelance or you are working for an outlet of some kind, I think they should be providing some level of support and protection, and it should be written into those contracts, because you're the ones doing the risk of the storytelling, the research, all of the behind-the-scenes work. You're the ones at risk. Sure, they'll be like, oh, CNN or NBC or The Grist or whatever, they're saying this, and it's like, they're not going to go after they're going to go after the people that publish that story. So I do think that there should be support, and I don't know what exists, but I would love to see the major outlets support their reporters more, because I think a lot of at least the major news outlets do a lot of safe reporting, so you don't necessarily see the same type of stories you might with others, but regardless, I think there should be protection.
Yeah, I would just add, there is a underdeveloped but growing legal infrastructure among a few writers' organizations to help give resources for this. One of the ones I'm familiar with is PEN America's Online Harassment Field Manual, and it has a sort of index of state guidelines against existing harassment. A lot of jurisdictions are using, there's existing harassment laws across the real space that are increasingly being applied to digital. And I know some journalism and other freedom-focused organizations are trying to push to update and add digital versions of that. And I'm not sure if it was in the National American of Science Writers, but another science group I'm in touch with, writers group, there is some advocacy work going on to extend that. Sorry, to pull this back, you know, a lot of this is really at the very, very roots of the way social media systems were built that allow all kinds of mis- and disinformation. One of the ironies of the TikTok debate, of course, is that you're seeing kind of a charade of concern over political rights and national security over this Chinese-owned entity. It's been under congressional review. It may, in fact, be either made illegal in the states or for federal workers, state workers already in many cases, with very little attention, of course, to the very documented meddling in individual journalists' lives or the political election last cycle from, state actors like Russia, China, you name it. I'm tilting at windmills a little bit here, but the point being that there is, I think, a reckoning and state-level kind of documentation of who's behind accounts is likely to increase in coming years, not decrease. Twitter's losing its mandate right now. I would never predict it will disappear off the face of the map, but we are living in a landscape of social media that is sitting on a graveyard of hundreds of other platforms that have failed after some period of time because they become so mismanaged. Elon could do that to Twitter. It's if it becomes just, so hard for you to be there, it's not serving your purpose as a journalist. And I'd say it's almost a question if you're in a place where that risk is so high, you have to make a decision a little bit. Are there other social media where it's better protected, the communities are more supportive and more reactive, and Twitter is its own, got its own energy and sort of, you know, its intensity around adversity there. It's really sharp. It seems sharper than the others as my eye sees it. It's hard to say that objectively, but that's a real dynamic among the platforms.
And I'll say with the, there are like alternates to Twitter starting to pop up. Mm-hmm. Mastodon is one of the more popular ones. There's a newer one. I'm not sure if it's released yet, but it's called Sprout.
Yep. Facebook is going to launch an alternative too.
Yeah, and so there's alternatives coming out, and I think that, you know, it just speaks to the, like what Adam just said, like the evolution of social media and other social related things that have happened over the years. I mean, MySpace was kind of the OG, LiveJournal, things like that, and now it has, you know, turned into a very different landscape. And I think that that's important to acknowledge, is that, like, Twitter was king of the social medias and still is, at least kind of for the most part, but there, you know, I think the reason that politicians are so scared of TikTok and using the guise of it being a foreign-owned company is because people are finding community and getting information mm-hmm. there that they can't get anywhere else, because Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, because it is now a Meta company, their algorithms are very different. The type of information suppression that happens is very different. And paying attention to what the politicians are paying attention to, I think, will tell you where social media is heading in general. And I agree with Adam that it's likely going to increase in terms of regulation. But I think the problem is, and what I'm about to say is a personal view, is that you have people in government who are over a certain age that truly don't understand what these social media platforms are or what they're doing. They don't know. They don't understand it. They think it's like their grandkids' like little dance video app or whatever. And when really it's turned into so much more than that, especially as the pandemic happened and, you know, you had the June 2020 protests where it was, you know, Black Lives Matter movement that really, I think, was part of the catalyst, especially for TikTok, in seeing like, oh, they're using these social media platforms beyond like sharing a recipe or photos or whatever. And I think that it's important to pay attention to what the politicians are paying attention to and why. Because mm-hmm. I think that'll show us what's going to happen in this country. Or hopefully not, if people decide they don't want the politicians to be doing that and meddling.
I think we have time for one more question.
Hey, everybody. Thanks so much for all of that you've said this morning. Appreciate it. I'm Greg Hanscom. I'm the publisher at High Country News and a proud former Grister. My question is, how are you thinking about whether or not to continue to engage on different social media platforms, and kind of what's the tipping point when you might disengage? I'll leave it at that.
That's a good question. Do you mind if I?
Yeah, go for it.
Honestly, I think it kind of depends on what people are using. We're not, you know, using a social media platform that people are not using. Why would we engage on that? I think on some regards, you want, especially us thinking out of it from a center's perspective, we want to be able to claim our handles. So we don't want somebody picking up our handles and going like, oh, I'm the, because that's something I see on TikTok a lot, is like you'll see the official account and then you'll see like 10 accounts, joke accounts, or like people doing that sort of thing. So on one hand, you know, on the most popular platforms, I would aim as a center to claim our handle and make sure that it's ours, even if we're not actively using it. And I think something like that is important. But as for how to kind of decide what you are or aren't using, I really think it depends on the landscape of that platform. Like, we're still using Twitter. We're still sharing tweets. You know, it's
it's not something like, again, our center uses social media in such a way that we're more sharing our research, news, things like that. So we're not necessarily always actively engaging in conversations, because honestly, most of those types of tweets that we've got have either people been like, yay, that's so cool you're doing this, or people just sharing big feelings. Like, for example, our center had a geoengineering event a couple days ago, and the event was a discussion about solar radiation management and like the different viewpoints on it. Because our center, again, tries to be nonpartisan and apolitical. That doesn't mean that the facts don't speak for themselves. But we had a wide variety of views on it. And the immediate reaction we got was, why is Michael Mann doing this conversation? Well, if you read the event description, you would know why we were doing this conversation. So I think, you know, again, for Twitter, we're using it in that way, to share information, to share what our center is doing, things like that. We're not going to actively engage with those people. We recognize that it's declining in a lot of ways. And I think that at some point, Twitter or any other platform becomes to the point where it's like, it's not worth posting on here, then we wouldn't. But I think it's very much a day by day or even week by week, depending on how quickly things do or improve or deteriorate, on how we decide to engage on platforms. And like, again, TikTok, like Sophia said, there's so much work that goes into a 7-second video that you don't think about. And then sometimes, like, you put all that work into one video, nothing happens. I did like a 5-second video using a stupid sound trend, and it got 1,000 views. And I was like, it doesn't make sense. So it's one of those things that you have to decide how much energy you're willing to put into a platform, because it could be very well that maybe a year or two from now, TikTok is not the popular app anymore. Something new comes along and becomes the popular app. I think it just depends on your needs and how that platform is being used and if it goes the way of Twitter or not.
My quick response is, like, the way I think about it for the Uproot projects is social media is... Is that platform serving our members in any way? Growing our audience is one of our goals. But for me, it's like, if enough uprooters leave Twitter, why am I going to stay there? Because when I post something, even if it's like, hey, go drink water, like I'm posting for our members, and if I have to go to Mastodon to remind them to go drink water, then I will. And that's the short answer, is my time best served towards my members, towards the Uproot members, by being there or not? Should I be making more funny videos to make them smile instead of doing tweets? Then at that point I will be doing more videos.
I think your question saying, is this serving our community? Nail on the head right there. Is it serving our community? Are we engaging the audience we aim to engage? That's what aims those decisions. And yeah, I think you couldn't have said it any better than that.
Well, thank you, everyone, for coming out. We know it's a very early Saturday morning panel, so we appreciate you all joining us today. Thank you.